This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective. I'm your host, Jason Mann, and today joining the show for the first time, Dutch Lombrowski of the Mighty Men of Mouse podcast. Dutch, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jason. Very excited for this tonight.
Well, thanks a lot for joining. We are going to discuss Survivor Series 1991. We're going to focus mostly on the Undertaker-Hulk Hogan world title match, the first singles match in Survivor Series history, but there's a lot of interesting stuff going on throughout the entire show and building to a show 6 days later, this Tuesday in Texas, which I understand you have tracked the number of times it is hyped during the entire show, so it'll be interesting to know at the end how many times we will have been inundated with this Tuesday in Texas.
You know, as a 10-year-old, when I watched this for the very first time, Jason, I didn't know anything about marketing, but I knew that I was being sold to a lot during this broadcast, and I just can't wait. Actually, I have it broken down by who said it and when.
Oh, very nice.
So it's not to give too much away, but Jake the Snake has the highest per minute instance of uses of this Tuesday in Texas.
That does not surprise me.
That's the type of stuff I bring to the table.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. So we'll kind of get into what was going on in WWF at the time. Of course, Hulk Hogan is your champion. He is in his third reign. He won the title at WrestleMania 7 against Sergeant Slaughter, regaining the belt. The Undertaker has been around for about a year. In fact, his debut was Survivor Series 90, so he's had a run. They say he's undefeated, but that's actually not exactly true. In fact, he has lost matches to the Ultimate Warrior, perhaps against others, but he's undefeated on the shows that matter, at least. No, very few people have actually seen him defeated, so you can get away, you know, it's plausible enough to call him undefeated heading into the show. But he's still very much the original Undertaker character, which is kind of an interesting character, because on paper, like, you could see the Undertaker being, like, not really a successful character. Like, it's just kind of silly, like, basically sort of a wrestling, you know, Frankenstein's monster almost. But obviously, The Undertaker is one of the legendary characters of all time in wrestling.
Yeah, and he really could have just been a pass-through, like, you know, fizzle out after 18 months, 2 years. And there was, and I think there was a big change from 1990 to this event. He still has that kind of Irish-Texan look to him. The hair is still more red than black, but he's moved away from the mullet of the previous year.
That's true.
And he's really upped the intensity in a non-goofy way. And you can tell he's starting to come into his own a little bit, just with the use of facial expressions and timing. And I don't know when the series was with the Warrior, but there was a marked increase in quality and storytelling and just overall job in the ring from the Warrior matches to the match he had Survivor Series and the one he had with this Tuesday in Texas. So
yeah. I believe that program with Warrior was pretty much the summer of 91, because of course Warrior leaves his last show is SummerSlam 91, kind of the infamous walkout there, sort of, you know. So I believe that was kind of heading into that. Although I don't know if that one didn't really last very long. I think it was cut off kind of because Warrior left, obviously. But, you know, Hogan's, you know, this is, you know, 7+ years of Hulkamania. He's not quite the same Hogan he was in 87. You know, he's not quite as big. He may be a little bit slower, a little bit older, you know, just a little bit. Maybe tired is the word, I'm not sure, but he's definitely, I mean, he's obviously, he has that appeal. He is very popular, and he's still clearly the man. But I think that there are some signs here, and we really get into them in early 92, where people are clamoring maybe for something else, you know, an alternative to Hogan.
Yeah, well, in this, you could really tell he had his winter weight on here. He didn't look anything like he did in at WrestleMania 7. But the there was at the end of the match when the spoilers, the Undertaker wins. There was an audible pop from the crowd, which you wouldn't expect from a 1991 crowd.
Yeah,
and that kind of goes straight into what happened with Sid Justice. You know, at the end of Rumble 92. And, you know, people kind of going crazy when Hogan was eliminated. And it was, you know, when he was still, you know, I was pretty young when this happened. And he saw this veneer of invincibility. And I still loved him in the way that Hulk Hogan was supposed to be loved at the time. So it was kind of jarring for me to go back and hear that. And actually, I think there were a couple of Undertaker signs in the crowd, which surprised me because this kind of strikes me as the wonderful time before crowd signs took over the arenas. So it was surprising to see the like the small little erosions of old, you know, Hulkamania that weren't there, you know, 2-3 years earlier.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, we're in a time where WWE is starting to, you know, the boom has happened. It's still popular in culture, but it's definitely, you know, the business is dropping. There's the sex and the steroid scandals that are, you know, WWF, the kind of their brand is being tainted a bit by, maybe even more than a bit by all that. And Hogan himself in particular, goes on the Arsenio Hall show and says that he only used steroids once to recover from an injury. You know, it takes kind of an obvious credibility hit when he says something like that. And so there's just kind of, you know, there's definitely you chinks in the armor, so to speak. And of course, you know, the fall of 91, Hogan, Undertaker is their focus, but they also have Ric Flair coming in from the NWA. He has the big gold belt, the old NWA championship, later WCW championship, now essentially the same title as the world heavyweight title, you know, at least the physical design of the belt. Brings that in. It has to be video distorted because of a lawsuit from the NWA. And they're playing up this Flair-Hogan rivalry. They're running it on house shows. It looks like that's the direction they're headed into in 92, but they're kind of doing almost the two simultaneous feuds. You know, the Hogan-Flair confrontation on the funeral parlor is kind of one of the big angle heading into this, where Flair runs him down and talks about, you know, how he's been waiting for this and how much better he is, and he's the real world's champ, and he's gonna, you know, expose Hogan as a pretender. And then Undertaker attacks from behind, hits him with the urn, and as Piper and Savage run out from commentary, they, you know, they chase Flair off with a chair, and they hit Undertaker with a chair, but it has no effect. And then you see Hogan, or Undertaker, standing over Hogan and sort of ripping off his cross and dropping the crucifix, very much playing off of the infamous Andre the Giant angle a few years earlier, where Hogan had torn, you know, or Andre had torn off the cross when he ripped off Hogan's shirt, which also happened, of course, heading into an event in Detroit, as this was in Detroit Joe Louis Arena. This did not quite big enough to sell the Silver Dome, but so playing off of that, but it's interesting how they use Flair as an ancillary part of this, and as a real almost carrying the side of the feud to a certain extent. I mean, Undertaker has that mystique, and Paul Bearer is obviously an effective manager, but you know, they're definitely using Flair to add notoriety to it.
Yeah, it was actually you know, watching it back now as an adult, it was interesting to see that the two main characters through a lot of the show, and the kind of the unifying thread through the whole show, it was Ric Flair and Jack Tunney. And, you know, the show opens with Jack Tunney and his announcement about reptiles being barred from ringside, and the first instance of someone saying this Tuesday in Texas. And you know, it's with, you know, in the opening match, you know, it has the video distorted world tag team championship belt that Flair was carrying around at that time. And later in a promo after this match and after Flair gets involved, he says that the whole reason why he did the run-in was he's the real world champion, and how dare Jack Tunney video distort his belt, and that this whole thing was retribution for what Jack Tunney had done.
Yes.
And so I thought that was an interesting thread, and it was actually the, you know, I'm sure there were authority figures, you know, angles before this, but it felt like, because even Earthquake and Typhoon were mentioning Jack Tunney about Jake being kicked out of the final match at the end of the evening. Piper cut a promo on Tunney after the Gravest Challenge. It just kept coming back to him. And it's slightly less insufferable now than the authority stuff that we have now, but it seemed to be kind of the thread holding the whole pay-per-view together. And that was a big part of the hype for going this Tuesday in Texas, you know, Jack Tunney promising to be at ringside.
Yeah, that, and this is definitely the first time. I mean, Tunney's been around for a few years, and he makes this, you know, he pops up every once in a while to make a big decision, but this is the first time I recall him being so heavily involved in a show, not necessarily for the better, but Tunney was not exactly the most dynamic performer. Not that they're expecting him to carry it to that degree, but
in a lot of ways, the movement was happening around that Flair Tunney thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's weird that Hogan, I mean, even to a lesser extent, like Hogan was put underneath that a little bit, and their feud was happening within that, with that contact. So it was a weird thing. And you know, the Undertaker, by the time the main event rolled around, and I think it was must have been February, because it was after the Rumble, you know, the Undertaker is a complete afterthought, you know, as everyone's basically kind of pinballed off in opposite directions.
Right.
But it was kind of a weird decision like this, and I don't know when the decision was to bring Flair into this, because I watched I watched a Texas Tornado Undertaker match from Superstars or Challenge, I can't remember which, and there was no mention of Flair. There was mention of the Gravest Challenge coming up and the match against Hogan, but no mention of Flair. And Heenan actually said that he couldn't imagine working with Paul Bearer, which, you know, was kind of odd considering where the story was going to take it. Mm-hmm. So you wonder when that decision was made, and you know what sparked that. So I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of a weird time in WWE storytelling too. I mean, they're definitely, it's taking a kind of a more like adult direction. In 91, beginning in this show, we see, you know, the whole Jake Roberts, Randy Savage, Cobra Bite angle, where Roberts, you know, takes a King Cobra snake out of the bag, and it bites Savage's arm. And you see the teeth, you know, go into his arm, and the officials, you know, run out, and Piper runs out, and Elizabeth runs out, and everyone's, you know, freaking out because they're frightened of the snakes, and no one wants to get into the ring, but they want to help Savage. And Savage is like stumbling around, acting like he's poisoned. He's trying to attack Roberts, and Vince screaming that he doesn't think the snake has been devenomized, and for God's sake, get Randy Savage out of there. You see kids crying in the audience, and there were a lot of and a lot of them surrounded the Undertaker and Jake Roberts, frankly, maybe not adult, but serious, there was also earlier in the year, there was Ultimate Warrior being stuck in the casket, by Undertaker,
Undertaker. I mean, Ultimate Warrior facing his demons when you see Undertaker, and I think Undertaker and Jake were in collusion for that, right? Because he shuts the door and it pans to him.
Right.
Yeah. It was really, really dark, and I always there were very, very intense, fantastic promos from Jake and Macho on this show, it carries over into this Tuesday in Texas, but that almost goes too far into the violence against women territory, and Snake cut one of the most disturbing promos I've ever I've ever seen.
Yeah.
After that, just the talking about hitting Elizabeth being the most funny he's ever had, something along those lines. It's just like, oh my goodness,
like it's an addiction, and he has a taste for it, and now he loves it, and I mean it's effective, and I it's so good that I can kind of put aside my distaste, a little bit because of just how effective it is. And that's definitely not just walking the line, but very much, it's crossing lines, but it is so fascinating and so well done. I mean, really the highlight of this show to me is building that Jake Roberts, Randy Savage, match for this Tuesday in Texas. I mean, we showed the angle at the beginning. Jack Tunney announces that Savage can't be at Survivor Series because of doctor's orders, but he says he wants the match to happen as quickly as possible, which he says will be the first mention of Tuesday in, I think he says this Tuesday night in Texas, and which is 6 days from the show. The Survivor Series was Thanksgiving Eve, so it was on a Wednesday. So 6 days later was the this Tuesday in Texas. He sanctions the match at the earliest possible convenience, I believe, is the thing. So Savage and Roberts, I guess, had been set as the captains of what ends up being the final match of this show, of the Big Boss Man, Hawk and Animal against IRS, Earthquake and Typhoon, but they were taken out of the match and it was made into a six-way. I know Sid was, I believe Sid
yeah, was I was about to say that, yeah.
Was supposed to originally be part of this show too, but he got hurt.
Yeah, he had, I think, and it's maybe the first time I ever heard of a bicep, but I think he had a bicep injury.
Okay.
And because all these stories were kind of tied together, because Sid made the save at Macho's wedding or right. the reception,
sure.
And Piper and Savage were constantly running into each other's storylines, and they were all running into so there was all this weird bleeding, I think Macho during his retirement was has some masked man thing where he was working house shows against Jake. And they, to save it for this Tuesday in Texas, they pulled him out of the match. But, the show really built up for that. And it was, the promos were really, really the highlight of the show. I mean, the one that Macho got was just so, so intense.
Yeah.
And so, and felt so real. And just the emotion that he was, and it wasn't him going full Macho with the, that kind of happened after the match at this Tuesday in Texas, but it was just like this quiet, really, really, really intense, really focused, and I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, and he talks about how he couldn't hear anything, or he could barely hear anything, but the one thing he heard was hearing Elizabeth cry, and how that felt worse than anything, any of the pain from the snake. And yeah, they really got some, good stuff going there. And basically, these promos are in between the matches. The first match is Flair, the Mountie, Ted DiBiase, and the Warlord against Roddy Piper, Bret Hart, Virgil, and Davey Boy Smith. Bret and Davey Boy on a team, probably not for the first time, but this was, of course, before their feud at SummerSlam 92 and before, of course, the Hart Foundation days in 97. This would have been, a few years after the big Hart Foundation British Bulldogs rivalry. So that kind of would have been my thinking at the time, would have been oh yeah, Bret and Davey Boy on a team together now after, after those years of feuding. So, and Flair and Piper were involved in a feud as well, around this time. Because really, Flair kind of, when he pops in, he kind of challenges Hogan right away, and of course they do the house shows, but that's not acknowledged on TV really. But it's Piper's kind of the guy who goes after Flair. They work some shows and are kind of feuding on TV. So in another one of those instances of kind of cross feuding, so to speak. And
and Piper, and not to interrupt you, Jason, there. Sorry, but Piper was an odd choice because I just watched today the Piper Flair Madison Square Garden match that's on that's on the network, and for someone who they're getting ready to make the face, the lead heel in the company, Piper took 90% of the match, and really made like in and I know and you know you don't need to come in and make Flair look you know look like Vader or something, but it's making him some type of credible threat to Hogan would have been useful. And, you know, if he couldn't handle Piper, who was, you know, who was a step down there, you know, it just didn't work there. And I don't like to second guess there. And I love Roddy Piper, but he didn't give enough. And I've been racking my brain to think about who would have been an adequate replacement there for Piper, to kind of, you know, fluff for Hogan and get him ready. And there really wasn't anyone else, because you have the, you know, Macho split off doing his thing, and you wouldn't want to lose that. So it was tough. And I mean, in terms of like the chemistry of them, like cutting promos on each other, they were fantastic. And the way they interacted with each other in the ring, aside from the action, but taunting each other was amazing. But the actual, you know, making Flair look great wasn't Piper's strong suit.
Yeah. And I kind of think that was sort of the similar problem with the Flair Hogan matches, which were entertaining and fine on their own, but they were just like Hogan running through another heel. They did certain things to make Flair feel big and special, but they undermined a lot of what made Flair special as well. Like Flair claimed to be the Real World's Champion, and if you were a wrestling fan and had knowledge of like Flair and the NWA, you would have understood that. But they also have Gorilla like constantly undermining his credentials. And you probably had a lot of fans who didn't see Flair as anything special because, like, you know, they're more WWF fans than they were wrestling fans, which is kind of what I've always thought why Flair Hogan worked better in WCW than in WWF, because WCW they of course respected Flair and they respected that wrestling tradition, and they had more of an appreciation of it than many WWF fans. Not to say that there weren't WWF fans who did respect it, but I think it worked better in the other promotion. That said, you know, I think if they could have done things differently to make Flair special, but obviously they didn't, and that's just kind of the way it worked out. And this the match here, I think, is a pretty good instance of that. I mean, the action is fine, but you kind of have Flair selling like normal for mid-carders like Virgil and Davey Boy, and so
he's afraid of Virgil. He doesn't want to tag in for Virgil.
Right, exactly. and the finish is really lame, too. I mean, basically, Davey Boy's eliminated first by Flair. Warlord is eliminated later by Piper. And then, like, Flair is thrown out of the ring, and then DiBiase, Mountie, Hart, Piper, and Virgil are all kind of in the ring and fighting, and then they're all disqualified, so your sole survivor is Ric Flair. And I know the Survivor Series doesn't, like, there are some lame endings, but that's probably, like, one of the most lame endings ever.
Yeah, and making it so Flair, because it wasn't like Flair snuck out of the ring. He was thrown out by Piper.
Yeah.
And just kind of got thrown out in the right direction, so not to be disqualified. It really didn't make him look great. And you think that at least let him mow down Virgil or Bulldog or... You know, I mean, even like Hart did some strong work with DiBiase at the Survivor Series the year before.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
That was fantastic. That was right after one of his brothers died. And that it was, you know, that type of moment, like him going mano a mano maybe with Bret Hart is the solution there. Or even Bulldog, because you got shades of that with the Rumble. I don't know. I would have liked to have seen Flair beat somebody here.
Yeah,
I mean, even if it involves, you know, like a perfect involvement or something, but
I mean, he did beat Davey Boy, but you know, after the top rope axe handle, but yeah, I mean, it was a it was not much of a you know, he didn't get a very strong showing. He just looks kind of like one of the guys. He's not like, you know, in an elevated way. He's just sort of like, you know, he's a new, and he's not, you know, like. And there are probably a lot of people who look at him and are like, well, he doesn't have big muscles and he looks kind of old. Why would he be special? You know, it's like that they did kind of have to work, and they did some of the work, but maybe not all of the work. And maybe they were just in a place where it just wasn't going to click no matter how hard they worked, because it just wasn't, you know, this wasn't 1988. You know, it was 91 and the landscape had changed, and Flair Hogan was still like a big deal, but it wasn't the big deal, you know, anymore, you know. I don't know.
But I think what they found that did work was when they made Perfect a bigger part of the story, and it turned everything into a 2-on-1. And I think if Flair, if there was any positive that during his stretch here through the following year and a half or whatever after this, was that especially against Macho and Hogan, he brought this sense of chaos, like almost this NWA sense of like the run in the Gravest Challenge, that there. The WrestleMania 8 match against Savage was very chaotic between Liz coming down and Perfect's involvement, and even going further even to Savage Warrior at 92, where both him and Perfect getting involved. It just seems like by giving him a little bit of a gang, he was back in a comfort zone for storytelling for him, mm-hmm. and it made him more believable that it was kind of the leader of the bullies.
Yeah, that's good. I hadn't thought about that. And I think definitely once he and Savage mix, I think just Savage was the perfect opponent for him. And everything with him getting in Savage's head with Elizabeth and so forth and everything that summer, leading into the Warrior Savage. I mean, all that stuff was pretty great. And even later when Savage takes Perfect away from Flair, and has his mystery partner, that like last minute, replacement for Warrior, that kind of happy accident. All that was good and compelling and fun stuff, but it definitely didn't feel like as big as you would have imagined it, say like in as I would have imagined as a kid, like in 1988. I mean, I was still a kid in 91, but I'd been through a few years of wrestling and obviously the landscape had changed. So I don't know if we have much to say about Sergeant Slaughter, Jim Duggan, Texas Tornado, and Tito Santana against Colonel Mustafa, Berserker, Skinner, and Hercules. Sergeant Slaughter is a good guy awful quick after, of course, being the Iraqi sympathizer.
It's easy to love America. So
apparently, I knew, I knew the time. I knew it, obviously. I remember it happening. I remember the vignettes, and, I kind of remember all of that. But it was just like, wow, yeah, they just went back into it. They didn't take any time off. He wanted his country back, and by gosh, he got it back, I guess.
Well, when you have an emissary like Hacksaw Jim Duggan, it's pretty easy. And he actually he wasn't originally supposed to be in the match. He replaced Jim Neidhart,
oh, okay.
who was taken out by Flair. Actually,
Yeah, I remember that. Okay, I didn't.
Apparently the Beverly Brothers. I don't know how, but Brain mentioned something about the Beverly Brothers being involved in it. And Hercules was actually a last minute add on after Big Bully
Busick.
Busick, I don't remember. I have zero memories of him. Thank goodness.
Very little. Okay, yeah, that makes sense because Hercules would have been, that would have been Power and Glory, but I think Roma was probably gone at this point. So,
yeah, and Hercules is actually on the interesting side of history here, or at least it's interesting to me because I care about this garbage. But he was the previous year with the Visionaries. He was the first team to have everyone on the team survive. And his entire team was eliminated without eliminating an opponent this time. So look at that.
Well, you win some, you lose some. Yeah. Wrestling is it's all about streaks, It's all about runs.
And he was not Hercules was not looking good here. Was not looking good at all. His physical decline is kind of jarring.
Yeah, so. A little bit. Yeah, that gut certainly becomes ample. He has the muscles, but also the excess weight as well. I guess you could call it the winter weight, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Then we get into, as we mentioned before, there were the promos in between the matches. First, there was the Savage promo, then the Jake Roberts promo. Jake Roberts, we can't not comment on his outfit with the Cosby sweater, the black leather pants, and the alligator boots, wearing the earring, like the triangle shaped or pendant shaped earring.
And it's terrifying too, because it's like a snake vomited on him, and he spends the entire time like touching himself in kind of like a weirdo creepy fashion,
yeah.
Like it's at one point he's like twirling his earring in his ear, and then he's rubbing his sweater, and just very creepy, very creepy. And you know, he warned us here that that he's always been the snake that we should have been worried about.
Yeah.
And I kind of have to agree with him in this one. It's pretty dark and pretty intense.
Yeah, he was really, the character didn't last long because he was gone by WrestleMania. But he really put his heart into it. I mean, and he had been, very popular for 3 or 4 years. I mean, he was, in the top five faces the entire time. And, you look back at some of those shows and he gets one of the biggest pops on the show all the time. He was really something special. And you know, watching him. But turning him heel at this point was, maybe not a risk, but it just sort of like – I mean, his character was doing fine. It wasn't like they needed to turn him. It was just kind of, it just was, they needed a heel, or maybe he wanted a creative challenge, or they thought it would drum up business or whatever. But it, at least creatively, it was awesome.
Yeah, and 91's a pretty memorable, it is for me at least, it's a pretty memorable year. And he had some of the best moments in it. A lot of people remember the snake at the reception and the all the creepy stuff with the Ultimate War, which I think is how we turned, right?
Basically the thing is that like he's training the Ultimate Warrior to be like survive against the Undertaker, and he's like putting him through all these like things and trying to like have him face his fears. And in the like in the very last one, it's revealed that he's, he's actually colluding with the Undertaker, and so for that, it's been a while since I've seen those videos. So I kind of forget exactly how it goes down, but yes, you're essentially correct.
Yeah, and he really just to bolster what you were saying, if you watch WrestleMania 7, he gets that crowd is pretty hot, and they are very very heated during the blindfold match.
Yeah,
and through the whole year, and especially 90, like because he had the match against Million Dollar Man that people laid up at six, and the Sewer Rat match, I think.
Sure.
And at Brennan's, and he really was like this. Probably it was him or Dusty Rhodes is like the second biggest face in the company during that time, and people loved him. I know I loved him.
Yeah.
And it, like that fit with the Undertaker was so perfect, and I really could have seen those two running together.
Yeah, that feels like something that could have lasted longer, almost like Jake Roberts is kind of a Kevin Sullivan figure, and then Undertaker is kind of like his main soldier. Type thing. And even if you have like Undertaker is the champion for a while, and Roberts kind of controlling him as the champion, I can see an alternate universe where you could have run with that, and that would have been really interesting.
Yeah, and he ended up doing, I think the he did a great job on with the Halloween Havoc 92 podcast. Because I think he was just really good during that stretch, and the match didn't deliver there, but the build up was great to it. I mean, that was the first WCW pay per view I ordered. And,
Although the spin the wheel, make the deal vignettes do not age particularly like well, but even in like that level of like corniness, just the way that it's filmed and the kind of the way it's presented, like he still like, and all the angles leading into it are very good.
Yeah, he's all aces.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah. Jake Roberts was good, kids.
Glad I could help.
Yes. So, so basically after the Jake Roberts promo, that's when Gorilla makes it official, says we're going to have TV coverage through pay-per-view of this Tuesday in Texas. So contact your cable provider and they'll get it for you. So we're about an hour into the show, hour and 20 minutes or so, when that announcement is made, and then we get Hogan versus Undertaker. So Hogan, Undertaker comes out first with Paul Bearer. Nothing notable that I saw in particular in their entrance. Hogan comes out afterward to the usual big reaction, and it is interesting that Gorilla portrays Hogan as having a wealth of experience. Not that isn't true, but that's the first time I can think of like a match where Hogan is presented as the veteran against a younger wrestler. Like I mean, obviously Warrior was younger than Hogan. I guess that was maybe more unspoken. I mean, obviously people knew that Warrior was the newer guy and could tell he was younger, but I don't recall Hogan ever being cast that way before.
He was more greatest athlete in the world than wily veteran.
Right, exactly.
Getting by on guile.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like Gorilla overplayed that, but he does talk about Hogan's wealth of experience and so forth. Hogan kind of circles Undertaker in the middle of the ring to begin. Undertaker shoves Hogan but misses a charge. Hogan locks in a headlock for a while but comes off the ropes and runs into an Undertaker shoulder block. Hogan then bails out of the ring for a little bit, which Gorilla calls the mark of a true champion, which might be slightly overstating it, but and Bobby says that he thinks that Hulkamania is dead, which also maybe slightly overstating things, but
in the mark of a coward.
Yes, the mark of a coward. Well, he does sort of praise it as smart, but then he also says that Hogan's a coward. So,
and I thought at this point when Hogan bailed too, and Hogan gets bagged on a bit in internet circles, but I thought he actually did a nice job with like facial work here, like the realizing for the first time that he had a long night of work in for him.
Sure,
and that he looked like you know, fear or however you want to say it, like you kind of got the sense of that when when he bailed out of there, and Hogan bailing out wasn't something he normally did.
Sure,
so maybe this side of Zeus.
Maybe concern would be a good word. So Undertaker gets Hogan by the throat, pushes him into the corner, and we get I feel like I've noticed this before, but never heard it quite this loud. Like Undertaker, when he does sort of like that choke in the corner, like he does like this sort of like this weird breathing thing. Like I don't know how to describe it, but it's almost like, you know, like he's like huffing, and it's kind of like coming through his nose. And,
yeah, it's a menacing wheeze.
Yeah, very good, menacing wheeze. Thank you. That is an exact perfect way to put it.
My little dog has it. So.
There you go. and then does kind of those underhanded thrust chops to the throat that he was would do sort of in his early days. That was kind of his primary striking technique. Also gouges Hogan's eyes. Undertaker holds Hogan's throat on the ropes while Bear holds the urn nearby. You get a lot of shots of Bear kind of being close and holding up the urn and encouraging Undertaker. And then while the ref's back is turned, Bear chokes Hogan for a bit and says, rest in peace, Hulk Hogan, and then does like a very goofy dance, which made me laugh. So good on Paul Bear.
Yeah, and I notice he kind of shakes it at Hogan and with the urn at
yes.
one point.
Yes.
And you hear it rattle.
I did not notice that, but yes.
So I don't know. Maybe that's where he's keeping his like pager or something.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
But the but it was an odd moment, and there is one point when Hogan was getting a little offense. Gorilla actually remarks that nobody is impervious to pain. Sooner or later, it gets you. And I think Gorilla was about 22 years too soon on this one, but I guess he was right eventually.
Yes, eventually he was correct. I will say that. If Paul Bearer has his pager in there, that would actually probably be useful for a funeral director. Because I imagine that funeral directors in 1991 need pagers, you know?
Yeah, you never know. Somebody come up with a snake bite or something.
You gotta get paged, you know? So at this point, there's a body slam by Undertaker, but he misses the jumping elbow. Man, Undertaker gets really, really high on like you see the normal signature spots that he would do throughout his career. You know, kind of like, you know, some of the jumping elbow and the flying clothesline off the ropes and stuff like that. But man, he does them really crisply and really fast and really high at this point. You know, obviously in his, you know, mid to late 20s at his athletic peak.
Yeah, he was an athlete.
He was.
And it really, like, you want to think just no one doing the rope walk before, and it wasn't called old school, thankfully, but the height they would get on that, and I enjoy old school Undertaker.
Sure.
Very much.
He was 26 at this point, so he was a young man. Hogan hits a few, tries to clothesline Undertaker down, but is unable to do so. He is unable to get him up for the slam, more just because of Taker's resistance rather than because Taker is heavy. However, he's able to land a running elbow that stuns Taker, and he rams him into the corners a little bit, and then he sort of... He clotheslines Undertaker over the top, but it is very much a polite clothesline. Like, he does not... It is noticeably not laid in. Undertaker lands on his feet. Hogan is pulled to the outside and is taken face first kind of to the steps. Hogan doesn't quite take it harshly. To put it, you know,
he's not Mick Foley.
No, he is. Hulk Hogan is not Mick Foley. That is a good way to put it. Then Undertaker, I don't know if I consider this kind of breaking character, but Undertaker grabs the microphone cord to choke Hogan as Paul Bearer distracts the ref. Do you feel like that's in keeping with the Undertaker character?
No, I mean, this was the first time you ever saw a really damaging offense to him, I guess, and I guess it would maybe be an excuse for a new bag of tricks from him, but he was someone who was such a, eventually phenom, or however you want to describe him, that you wouldn't think that he would need a fat man to distract the ref for him.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it's just sort of, it is an odd thing to see. I mean, you know, I it's not a criticism, it's just sort of like huh, okay, like Undertaker, you know, it's sort of like I get that he's a bad person, and I guess he's not like above cheating, but I kind of think of like Undertaker at this point wouldn't think to cheat, you know, like it wouldn't occur to him.
Well, I mean, he did like sneak up on Hogan and hit him with the urn, right? I mean, I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, all bets are off when you're facing the greatest athlete in the world.
You got a point there.
Flags fly forever, Jason. So,
so Undertaker chokes Hogan on the floor. We get more Paul Bearer interference. Bobby Heenan has a funny joke about how every time Paul Bearer interferes, he says his monitor keeps kicking in and out.
Yes, that was great.
And I will say I don't sense much heat for this match for a good bit of it. I don't know how you felt about that, but I kind of feel like there is a brief, in fact, right after I write this, there is a brief where the fans kind of chant Hogan and get back into it for just a little bit, but it doesn't really, it's not quite there, you know?
Yeah, well, during that Hogan chant, it's he was actually thrown out of the ring and he's coming back in and they're doing chanting Hogan, 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 and he walks straight into a chokehold. And so it doesn't really, it would have been nice to get something just to keep the crowd engaging a little bit.
Sure.
But you know, I felt like Hogan was pretty generous in this match in that he really made the Undertaker's offense look really good, I thought, for the most part. And you know, I think that maybe took the crown out of it, because like listening to it, because I was a little concerned. I was worried that, you know, maybe I had misheard something, because you had posted on Twitter like you were concerned about the crowd reaction here, and you are right, like during the match, but like leading up to it, like the crowd goes crazy when he enters.
That's
it doesn't
true.
Feel like
yeah.
It doesn't feel like Hulkamania is dead, but then like there's the crowd seems disengaged except for a couple of points, and then the performers don't do a great job of keeping it in it.
Yeah, because we're about to hit a very, very long claw hold.
2 minutes.
Yeah, that keeps Hogan like literally lying on the mat for, you know, 75% of that time. And yeah, that pretty much Hogan does rally. He gets to his feet. He breaks it, nails a kick to the gut and shoulder blocks. But Undertaker comes off the ropes with a flying clothesline to send Hogan down again. And that one was a very good, you know, surprise. You kind of wouldn't expect him to do that in the position that he was in. And then Undertaker hits the tombstone, and then Hogan pops up right away and starts to Hulk up.
No.
Yes. And he punches Undertaker down. He starts to call for the slam. And we see Flair come down to the ring. Hogan does slam him. He sort of he goes to the ropes, but Paul Bearer grabs the leg. And that's kind of weird. Like, Hogan goes to the outside, and he hits Flair from behind. Flair's kind of over by the ring announcer, timekeeper, you know, maybe grabbing a chair or trying to do something.
He's actually trying to grab the belt, actually.
Oh, there you go. Okay, trying to grab the belt. That makes sense. Okay. Heenan pointing out that Flair really didn't do anything there. Hogan goes back in. He lands the big boot, but then when he goes to the ropes, Paul Bearer grabs the foot again. This allows Undertaker to recover and get Hogan in the tombstone position. Flair slides a chair under the rope, and Undertaker hits the tombstone with quite a bit of air under Hogan's, noticeably, 6 inches under Hogan's head, which is going to come into play in a minute as well. If you didn't notice that,
It is the safest tombstone in the history of tombstones.
Probably, yeah. Maybe there's one on Vince or something, but yes, basically. So we get the 1-2-3. Undertaker wins. As I believe you mentioned before, there's a pretty big pop for it. Two kids in particular get really excited on the front row. Now, the pop doesn't exactly surprise me because it is like there is even during this time, like the pop for the big title change is always going to be kind of something that happens. What sort of surprises me is that right afterward, Hogan is down for a long time. He's holding his neck. There's a bunch of officials who are, surrounding him. You guys we know, like Pat Patterson's there. I think Earl Hebner, Morella, a mix of referees and the, Rene Goulet. Danny Davis, guys like that. So they're all kind of around expressing concern on Hogan. He really doesn't move hardly at all. Undertaker and Bearer leave with the title. Undertaker's music's playing, and then Hogan is down for a long time. The Heenan and Gorilla reference, they say a Lions player without mentioning his name. He was Mike Utley.
Did you know that, or did you look that up too?
I didn't know his name, but I remember when it happened.
Yeah, because I had to look it up, and he actually has a foundation for people who were paralyzed.
Yes,
and he's still paralyzed. So
it was very, it was a big deal at the time, and it happened roughly a week, before this match. In fact, they say that Hogan actually went to visit him in the hospital. And I wonder, are they trying to play off of that?
It's because Hogan, who has sold some major fake major injuries, like rib injuries in the past, that they've never gone for the spine like this before.
Yeah.
And the way they gingerly bring him out and like the officials checking on him, it was unique at the time. And the way that they mentioned the Utley thing is kind of concerning. Like you'd hate to think that they were being exploitive of that moment.
Right.
But that's the type of pop culture thing that you feel like Vince McMahon would gravitate to, and I'm a big fan of Bobby, but he completely went over the line with a joke about them sharing a room together.
Yeah, now. Yeah, that
and
one
it was
really
and
bad.
It was just like, God, I know it's tough, I know it's live TV, but that was just horrible. And Gorilla had a line like, well, it's either a broken neck or a fractured clavicle. I don't know. It was I do think it was a reference to that, and I think the fact that they lingered on it so long, and didn't go back to Hogan later in the show, was telling.
Yeah.
So
now, we'll get back to that. But what I, right after, okay, Hogan is slowly is helped up, and he's he's dazed, and he's he eventually gets out of the ring, but he kind of uses the apron to sort of help him as he's walking. It's odd because the crowd doesn't clap or cheer anything when he sits up and when he gets out of the ring to recover. Like, eventually he kind of makes his way around, and there is sort of a mix of cheers and boos. But it's an odd reaction to a pretty unique situation for Hogan. And I don't know, maybe the maybe it's on the crowd's mind that they're playing off of Mike Utley and they don't like it, but I'm not sure. But it is sort of odd. Now, Lance Storm has told a story, and I was reminded – I actually remember hearing it, but I'd forgotten about it, but I was reminded on a post of Pro Wrestling Only that Undertaker and Flair had told Lance Storm this story, that Undertaker was afraid that he had seriously hurt Hogan with the tombstone. And then later he and Flair looked at a monitor and realized that, like, you know, it had missed by 6 inches and that hadn't happened. And it was even reported in their Observer as a legitimate injury because, you know, Hogan doesn't do the promo at the end of the show. They have Sean Mooney relay what Hogan told him, essentially. They don't mention, like, oh, Hogan's hurt. You know, they don't play into that injury at all at the end of the show. It's just like, okay, Hogan Undertaker is going to happen this Tuesday in Texas, you know? So it's a weird kind of, like, who do you believe kind of thing. But I guess the idea that the reason that Hogan, their theory, the reason that Hogan did this was is sort of like a Undertaker's a young guy who can't work and I'm protecting my spot kind of thing.
Well, yeah, it was obviously trying to I mean, that's why Flair, I mean, that's not why Flair, but that's why the chair is involved. And yeah, I mean, the Hogan, with the exception of a warrior, didn't lay down for anybody at this point or for a very long time.
Well, but I mean, like, as in a, like, this is like a backstage type, you know, like a, like, I mean, obviously the chair was used as a justification for, like, Hogan losing the match. It was, you know, added, like, you know, he had to hit him with a tombstone in the chair to do it. You know, Hogan is still great, but I mean more as like a, you know, as like a, oh, Undertaker is reckless, so, you know, so he shouldn't replace me kind of thing. You know, and, you know, Hogan's older at this point, you know, and you could see Undertaker being a guy who he might feel a little threatened by. And obviously Hogan's, I mean, he's, you know, in 5 months, he's about to leave the company, you know, and sort of an open-ended thing and, you know, say maybe he's retiring, you know, and trying to get into acting because obviously the wrestling business is downturn and he's had some damages because of the steroid scandal. So, you know, I obviously don't know the truth, but
and there might be something to that because, you know, there wasn't the consistently, you know, you think if you set up this big, seemingly big looking injury, you would have it play somehow into the match at 6 days later.
Right. And it absolutely, they forget completely about it.
Not at all.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you think it like Macho Man has spent the last half of 92 pretending to limp around.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, I don't know. It was a odd choice to not play into that at all, or I don't know, have Undertaker work the neck or something. It seems like a lot of wasted energy here.
Right. Which leads me to conclude that, you know, Hogan was just going into business for himself. So, or gives me, you know, maybe not conclude, but I think that's pretty good evidence for that theory. But so, you mentioned the, you know, there's the Piper promo and the, you know, that we've just seen an injustice, of course. There is also the Flair promo where he kind of went into what he talked about before. He and Perfect. I do think that Flair's motivation and the fact that now you talk about it sort of being like a thing, like an anti-Tunney thing, I think makes it make a little bit more sense. But the idea of, like, you know, I did this because now I'm clearly the best champion is sort of an odd, like, conclusion to leap to. I know Flair's a heel, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think it was more that it was just retribution.
Sure.
For the indignity of having the belt blurred out.
Yeah.
Because even Gorilla, going back to the opening match, Gorilla went through this play scenario where Jack Tunney very nicely asked Ric Flair to take off the belt, and Flair says, "I will absolutely not. I will wear whatever I like," which I could exactly picture Ric Flair saying.
Sure.
So I like the idea of it. I like to see things tied together, and the idea that the whole thing was retribution, and that's the thread of the evening. I think that makes sense, but
sure.
You know, him hating Hogan makes just as much sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously part of it too. And Yeah, and it's funny because I believe it, like during that beginning match, Gorilla says like, "Oh, we don't even know where he won it." You know, like there's no record of that whatsoever. Like, I mean, he says he won it, but I don't know. You know, it's just the funny, you know, WWE completely like there's no other wrestling in the world besides what we know. Of course not.
And I tell you, it was a shame. I mean, because the Flair promo was so good.
Yes.
And he got to a place in that one, and it's a shame that it went nowhere. And that's the, you know, going through all this, it really it kind of bums me out that there wasn't a pay, you know, the payoff to this is Sid versus Hogan.
Yeah.
In one of the worst WrestleMania main events of all time.
Yeah. We do get Savage Flair, which is a pretty awesome consolation prize, which is one of the best.
It's pretty kicking. Matches. Pretty kicking.
Yeah. So even though that sort of cut short a little bit, Savage Jake Roberts, which, you know, you definitely could have milked that through WrestleMania, and that would have been awesome. But then again, I really like, even though it's short and basically one sided, I really enjoyed the Undertaker Jake Roberts match at WrestleMania 8 too. You know. And people were into The Undertaker, and even though, yeah, it was a little soon for babyface turn, maybe, I thought that stuff clicked really well, too. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what kind of business Hogan Flair would have done at that point, but you definitely Hogan Flair at WrestleMania 8 would have, like, been, like, another, like, you know, in the canon of great WrestleMania matches that people would reference and would talk about and be part of that, like, WrestleMania mythology. And the fact that it isn't, you know, diminishes it, I guess, you know, it a little bit. But I'm pleased with everything that we got instead of it, other than, of course, Hogan Sid, which even at least has that, you know, cool Ultimate Warrior run in and that surprise, you know, that huge pop and everything. But yes, obviously, the fact that it is baffling that they didn't find a way to do, you know, Hogan and Flair in a big way, even despite the circumstances of what was going on at the time and Hogan leaving and so forth.
You see, I'm selfish. I would have liked to have seen it all happen, you know, and I guess too, you know, kind of putting the belt on the Undertaker in some ways diminished the title in 97, you know, or, you know, him getting it, like it was just a waste of throwing on him for 6 days. You know what I'm saying there?
Yeah, and it does a little bit like, and they weren't building to it anyway, so I guess it didn't matter, but you know, the whole, the idea if you're building to champion versus champion to have Hogan lose it and regain it, but I guess the point was to get it off of both of them to do the Flair at the Royal Rumble, which obviously was awesome too. So, yeah, there's a lot of trade-offs. It is easy to imagine like cooler stuff, but the stuff that we got, you know, a lot of it was cool as well and was real and was, you know, memorable and, you know, and iconic. So it's tough because, like, you know,
that's a pretty good hour of wrestling between Hart and Piper and Flair and,
right.
Flair and Savage.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's really good. Yeah. I was in this era gets kind of crapped on a little bit because I know it wasn't the best time for business and everything, but between like the talent that was floating around and, you know, Bret Hart just, you know, embarking on his singles career, and you still had Piper and Savage and Hogan and Flair and Undertaker coming along. It was just, I was just lucky to come up at this time, and it was fun. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I think it kind of laid the groundwork for what happened after. So.
Sure. So the next match is the Nasty Boys and the Beverly Brothers, contrast in styles against the Rockers and the Bushwhackers, so I guess are a contrast as well. This is a very long match, or feels very long. It's not particularly great. I guess the big story of it is well, Luke and Butch are eliminated first, so the Rockers are kind of facing at a disadvantage. Although they're able to eliminate Bo Beverly, but Michaels is Jannetty nails Michaels with a move, or somehow distracts him during like some of their double team stuff, and he ends up being rolled up and loses. And of course, this is a step for their further disintegration, which is going to lead to, of course, you know, the possibly the most memorable tag team breakup of all time right at the beginning of 92.
Yeah, you want to talk about laying the groundwork for the future here. And it's in hindsight, a lot of people say that, you know, it was obvious that Shawn Michaels had was the talented one here. But I thought Jannetty was great in this.
Yes.
And they both were great. I mean, Shawn was fantastic. But there were really only like two flurries of like great activity. It was both Rockers. Early on, Shawn did hit like a clothesline from the apron, like a running clothesline on the apron onto one of the Nasty Boys. And he took out basically the whole heel team on the other side. And Marty had a similar spot, I think, after Shawn was eliminated or right before he was eliminated. And it was just really good action. And so it was interesting. And I thought the friction was very effective because it wasn't just, you know, one guy being mad at the other. He kind of like Shawn actually like pushed Marty into the heel corner on the way out and said, go get him. And I thought it was pretty effective. I mean, they probably beat on Jannetty for about 5 minutes too long. Probably could have handled that in like 2 minutes and got the quick pinfall and out of there or something. But it was, I thought it was pretty good. I was a big Rocker fan growing
sure,
up. So.
Sure. And honestly, that wasn't nearly as egregious as in the final match, which, as we mentioned, is Big Boss Man, Hawk, and Animal against IRS, Earthquake, and Typhoon. I'm pretty sure it's between the two matches in which we get the Jack Tunney announces that Hulk Hogan is going to get his rematch at this Tuesday in Texas against The Undertaker.
And he'll be there.
He'll be there.
He'll be there.
He'll be there. He's okay. He's just shaking up a little bit. It's all right. The clavicle has been repaired in the 25 minutes since in between the match. So,
well, I love that the most likely concussed Hulk Hogan is caucusing with Jack Tunney.
Yes.
So I'm just picturing like a lot of like scotch and cigarettes in like the back locker room.
Yeah.
So
I'm feeling okay, brother. You know, I wonder if Hogan brothered Jack Tunney. like I mean, he brothered everyone, so I would imagine so, but I just have a hard time imagining like him brothering Jack Tunney. Like, even not like Jack Tunney like the character, like Jack Tunney the guy, like, you know, like I wonder what Jack Tunney the guy was like to hang out with.
He looked I think he made an appearance like during the Wrestling Classic, and
I think it was his first like appearance as WWE president,
and he looked like he had a little bit more like a healthy weight on him, and
yes,
was looking good and ruddy.
Yeah.
And by this one, I mean, like, it looked like the scotch and sodas had taken their toll on him.
Well, I mean, let's face it. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of times 6 years into your presidency, that's going to be like the time in which you have like the scandals and the difficulty and the challenges. And, you know, Jack Tunney 6 years into his presidency, look at Obama, you know, how he's aged in 6 years, you know?
Yeah, the gray hair and everything. I like to think that he, like, Tunney, it wasn't that the official decision was final, that he fell asleep during the Graves Challenge.
Yes.
And wasn't able to make the decision. And that's why Flair had to hold him up at this Tuesday in Texas.
Sure. So. that makes perfect sense.
These are the type of things you come up with when on your third or fourth viewing of a pay-per-view that's 23 years old.
Sure. So the Road Warriors are tag champions at this point, you know, and I don't know if you quite call it a dream feud, but there is kind of some excitement of like Hawk and Animal, you know, against Natural Disasters, to these two beefy tag wrestlers, you know, kind of unlike any team that WWE had seen in a while. The Natural Disasters were, I mean, most of the tag teams were kind of, I mean, Demolition obviously were big, powerful guys, but they weren't that beefy. You know, I mean, it was, they were sort of a different dynamic, kind of, you know, a potential super team in a sense, you know, like a, you know, so I think there was some sort of excitement, you know, in that rivalry. I don't know if it ever really kind of got to where it could have gone. I know Hawk had some personal problems. They lost, Road Warriors ended up losing the belts to Money Inc. not long after this, and kind of petered out in WWE.
It's really a shame because they had the match at the Rumble that ended in a DQ,
right?
And I think Hawk DUI'd himself, or something happened prior to WrestleMania 8, and that's why they lost the belt. Because
I think he had a drug suspension, I believe.
The Legion of Doom, like they were the amount of nuclear heat here for them was so great, and you could really hear it in, I think it was like Albany. That's where the Rumble was.
Yeah.
That place was really, really into that match. And they were supposed to face the disasters at WrestleMania 8. And kind of after that, that's when the tag division kind of petered out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like the Rockers were broken up. Demolition had basically been mothballed after Legion of Doom came in.
Sure. Foundation were gone, you know.
And so the whole division's dismantled. And then the cornerstone of it, you know, has his personal demons, or half of it has personal demons. And it kind of leaves the division rudderless, and you have like High Energy, and I can't even remember who was around in the mix later '92. It got weird quick.
It's like Bushwhackers,
the Nasty Boys were faces and stuff. It got really
Beverly
weird,
Brothers,
and it went from like the one of the best things WWF did to one of the worst pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of slowly drifting that way already. I mean, I think that even the tag division in 90-91 was weaker than it had been like in 87, 88, 89, you're definitely right. This is kind of the end of that great division, which was, a really fun part of, the mid-card for, even maybe it wasn't ever like the main event topping, but it was kind of like the cruiserweights in WCW. Like, you had a lot of, like, fun, interesting matches that made the shows, fun to watch, even if they weren't necessarily the thing that were drawing you in.
Yeah, and that was, those were some of the highlights of the earlier Survivor Series, those huge tag team matches.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was just great. And, the Natural Disasters were really the first big Hoss team since like the Powers of Pain and Demolition when they first came in.
Yeah. But even they were like a step above that, I guess, I think they even had like an added, because they were, just freakishly big,
Well, and Earthquake was a main eventer who had put Hogan on a shelf. Like they were legit threat, and like they even went at Andre, I think, at like SummerSlam 91. Like after they crushed the Bushwhackers, they tried to take out Andre, or they did take out. I can't remember.
I think they took him out earlier, and then Andre was in their corner then, or in.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the LOD comes down for the save.
Exactly. Yes. Boss Man shows off a lot of quickness and agility here and there throughout the match. He's eliminated first via a IRS hitting him in the back of the head with the metal briefcase. Just is noticeably, yeah, hopefully most people or everyone listening knows that Big Boss Man was awesome and Ric Flair was really good, and you should seek him out. But just really like showing off that, just sliding in and out of the ring with ease, and just doing some cool stuff early on in the match to kind of make it interesting. Once he leaves, the match definitely kind of slows down. IRS ends up accidentally nailing Typhoon with the case, and this angers Earthquake to the point in which he decides, you hit my partner, I'm going to leave as well. So he's countered out. So we're down to LOD against IRS, and I feel like they beat him up forever. I guess for a while IRS actually like has the advantage, even though it's kind of 2-on-1.
Yeah, it was a bizarre choice there. Like I feel like these last two matches they kind of were twitchy, because in the Rockers match it would have been nice to see the Rockers maybe eliminate two of the heels, and in this one it was like to see IRS like beat up the fresher animal.
Right.
Was just odd, and then the end seemed very, very rushed.
IRS tries to walk out, and then Bossman comes out of the entrance and won't let him, and then IRS slides back into the ring, and I think Animal hits him, and then Hawk does a clothesline off the top. They don't even do the Doomsday device, and then Animal gets the pin, and that's it. So
yeah, and it's from, I think Bossman hits the aisle with like 4.5 minutes left on the, in the pay-per-view.
Sure.
So, you know, it must have been a miscommunication or something, because it happened extremely, extremely quickly. It was kind of surprising. I mean, hit IRS with the Doomsday device. I mean, that the crowd would have been very, very excited to see that. So.
Yeah. I mean, him with top rope clothesline, which isn't too bad, but I mean, they did have to go, because afterward they go to Sean Mooney, who says that, you know, that Hogan has the eye of the Hulkster.
Yes.
And says that Hogan says, brother, I'd rather do my talking in the ring. So they don't say that Hogan is too hurt. They, as we mentioned, they say, like, Hogan just doesn't want to talk. And I guess the reason he didn't is because he supposedly was hurt, but as we discussed earlier, he really may not have been hurt. Or, you know, I also, somebody else, maybe quoting from the Observer, said that the pile driver, it wasn't from when, obviously, it was more like when his head ran into Undertaker's knee or something along those lines. It was something else rather than the drop down. But either way, not that we need to get back into that again, but... so he's not there. Brother, I'd rather do my talking in the ring. And then we end with like Undertaker and Paul Bearer in the bowels of Joe's Arena. Mean Gene not knowing where he is, but he and then Bearer.
But he feels very uncomfortable.
He does feel very uncomfortable.
I don't know where I am, but I'm very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable.
And it's steamy in there. And we have Paul Bearer and the Undertaker, you know, cutting a promo with our final mentions of this Tuesday in Texas. So, are we ready to go through this Tuesday in Texas mentions?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, there are 35 total, and this pay-per-view was only, I think, like 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Yes.
So I don't have the permanent rate, but so there were 35 total. There was actually the gold medal is split between Brain and Gorilla, with 10 each.
Okay.
Mean Gene had 5. Liz had 1, Macho had 1, Snake had 3, and Sean Mooney had 2, all at the end. So he was trying to cram it in there, but not as fast as Jake Roberts.
No.
So.
Well, very good.
35. I'm glad I could share that with you.
Yes,
it's in the record books now.
I'm going to go ahead and guess that no one has ever mentioned that on a podcast before.
That's a fairly safe assumption.
History has been made.
History has been made. That's perfect.
So I mean, this leads into this Tuesday in Texas, which has, of course, the Savage Jake Roberts match, Hogan versus Undertaker, which I think that this Tuesday in Texas match might be a little better. And it has Hogan regaining the title thanks to using the urn. I think he hits Undertaker with the urn, and then he opens it up and he throws the ashes in his face and he rolls him up. He does a lot of cheating. Now, this is after there's been a lot of cheating by Undertaker, Paul Bearer, and Flair as well. Flair comes out to ringside again. Jack Tunney is knocked out during this. I think the highlight of the show really is Savage and Roberts. The match, which is very good, but really what is excellent is the and harrowing afterward, where Roberts, threatens to attack Savage. Goes under the ring, grabs a bag, thinking that there's going to be a snake. He DDTs Savage several times and looms out there. Elizabeth comes out to try to help, and he ends up shoving her down, you know, which is just like one of the most like this would have been like best angle of the year of almost any year, and yet it was like the second or the third best angle of this storyline, you know. So, yeah, but it's an incredible continuation of their story. There's also a Bret Hart Skinner match, and Davey Boy Smith and Warlord continue their year-long feud, and Ted DiBiase and Virgil continue their year-long feud with Repo Man and El Matador Tito Santana joining in. So,
it's a pretty disjointed card. I mean, other than Hart Skinner, which is pretty good at the end, and the Jake Roberts stuff, it's a pretty tough watch.
Yeah,
I disagree. I think the Hogan's gets a lot more offense in the Undertaker match in that one. But the end is so clumsy, because it's Hogan knocks Flair into Tunney, and then Flair hits Taker with a chair, and Bearer hits hits Taker with, like, and between that and at the end, like, there's this, and I mentioned this earlier, this bizarre thing where Flair's holding up Tunney's corpse so he can see Hulkster cheating.
Yes.
Which was just very, very bizarre. It wasn't something we had seen really any of before. And I was just a WWF guy at this point. I only knew a little bit about NWA, WCW from like PWI stuff. But it was really odd. It was really odd.
I guess
even the, because like Tunney hung around to watch Hogan celebrate and to talk to Joey Morella, and it was just like the Hogan celebration seemed off, and I don't know, the whole thing kind of was like 10% wrong or 5% wrong.
Yeah, I guess I would say I liked it a little more. I guess it had better energy. Like it didn't seem quite as there wasn't quite as much dead space going on.
The mandible was only a minute in this one,
right? So it was a little more chaotic. I agree with you that it got very convoluted, but of the two matches, I think it's a little more watchable. Neither one is a classic by any means, but you're right. This Tuesday in Texas is, other than the Hart Skinner match is okay, and the Savage Roberts stuff is definitely very, I'm not quite sure it's must watch, but it's close. But other than that, yeah, this is not exactly a stellar show. So, yeah, is there anything else that that you would like to discuss surrounding any of what we've talked about?
No, not at this point. I think we covered it pretty well.
All right. Sounds good. Why don't you tell everybody about the Mighty Men of Mouse podcast?
I'm sure what we do would interest almost none of your listeners. My other hobby is I love travel, and I have a small family. So, and me and my buddies that I went to high school and college with, we talk about Disney World and family travel and all that stuff. So it interests probably no one except us. But
I don't know. You never know.
But we have fun. We have fun with it. It's I'm always amazed just how like fan communities are a lot alike, and the and wrestling and theme park fans are, it's very, very similar. There's almost this love-hate relationship with your hobby at times.
Sure.
And that there were certain, just certain dynamics of fandom always interest me. And, you know, what we do is, we're Moneyball meets family travel in terms of that stuff. Cause we try to, you know, think a little bit deeply about it and get into analysis and all that stuff. So it's it's a lot like what you do in terms of taking deeper dives on stuff that people kind of maybe would walk by or, you know, not take the time to look at. So that's what we do.
Cool. Have you ever been to Cedar Point?
I have not. I have not.
I love Cedar Point very much. It's my favorite happy place. And I love roller coasters so much. Like I'm a big roller coaster person, and Cedar Point is just just so exciting and so fun and so amazing. So I don't know how much you're into the roller coaster aspect of it, or if you're more into the other aspects or both. But just curious. I took a trip to Disney World last year. I went there once when I was a teenager, and then I went again last year with my daughter, who was 4 at the time, and my mom, and then some other family. And I was really impressed with just the level of like how they take care of everything, and like how professional it is, and how like there is, you know, there's very little like that isn't thought of, I guess. There.
Yeah, it's they do a lot of storytelling and trying to make you feel like you're in a time and place, mm-hmm. and that's really what, aside from the food, is really what makes it pop for me. And you know, it's a lot of fun, and it's a unique place, and that really element of story. Like if you go into a space, I like knowing that there's a reason why just about everything is in there.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Yeah, are you a fair person at all?
We don't really. I'm up in Rhode Island, New England, and we don't really get them.
Oh, okay.
There's one that's it's just a regional thing. We have one that's really really small. In the fall, but you know we don't really get anything else.
Okay. Yeah, I'm
anything awesome like you guys get out in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So.
Columbus. I live in Columbus, Ohio, and the state fair. It's just a few miles from where I live. So. And it's huge, and they have a lot of things, and my daughter absolutely loves it. So we, try to go a couple times, and spend most of the day there and ride the rides. And I like to indulge in the terrible fair food, as sort of a, as an indulgence. It's a lot of fun. So I'm big into into that kind of stuff. Those are fun times for me. There are some people who are like who think that kind of thing is terrible, and sometimes the crowds cannot be fun, and there are aspects of it that aren't cool, but for the most part I'm all in.
I have three little ones, 4, 2 and 5 months.
Oh, wow.
Finding stuff that's good for your whole family and
sure.
That people enjoy, and I know like a lot of people bag on like the PG era of wrestling, but it's really awesome to be able to like put it on, because I'm always looking for stuff that can entertain my family, and like being able to put wrestling on without having to my kids are in the room is a nice thing.
Yeah.
And being able to vacation somewhere where my kids are having fun and I'm not worried about them making noise or ruining someone else's dinner, it's a pretty nice feeling.
That absolutely. Yeah. I haven't really shown Scarlett wrestling yet. Like I don't know. Like, I'm not exactly sure, like if I really want to, or if I'm interested in her getting into it, or if I just kind of want to avoid it, or if she would be interested. I mean, she might, but at the same time, I mean, I doubt she'll ever care about it as much as I do. But like, there is so much that's problematic about wrestling, even PG era wrestling, that I kind of feel like, gee, should I just, like, I'd really love if she liked basketball. Basketball is kind of the other thing that that I'm a pretty big fan of. So that's less problematic, I think. But yeah, it is nice when you have kids. That is something you definitely, what you consume for your entertainment changes a lot, because obviously you have to consume things they care about, or you end up watching a lot of kid shows with them just because that's, that's what they want to watch. And
yeah.
If you want them to be entertained, that's going to be that's a big part of it. So,
yeah, my entire teens and 20s were nothing but basketball, and then I had kids.
I'm
lucky if I get watch Celtics once a week now,
which
makes me infinitely sad.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, we got to make sacrifices. I sacrifice kind of every other sport that I ever had any interest in. Basketball is kind of the one that, and wrestling are kind of the two. Things that I kind of still stick with and follow closely, and I just don't really have time for much else. And I've watched very much less wrestling and basketball than I would like to, but life gets in the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And you want to do things too. You don't want to just sit around and watch stuff all the time too. But
the amount of Saturdays and Sundays I've lost NBA playoff games.
Oh yeah.
That's the best weekend of the year. But, oh well. Oh well.
Oh well.
That's what retirement's for.
All right, Dutch. Well, thank you so much for being on the program. I really enjoyed the discussion, and I appreciate it. Oh, you know what? We do have a Twitter question. I was a slacker, and I forgot to ask for Twitter questions ahead of time. We do have one. I will say, and I don't remember this, Mass Tweeter asked us, was it a letdown that Hogan wasn't put in the casket after the match as Bear had promised? I don't remember him actually promising that. I will believe Mass Tweeter that he, he wouldn't let me down. He wouldn't tell me, he wouldn't fib. So I believe that is true. But was that a letdown for you?
It was. I know Bobby promised it at the beginning of the show,
oh, okay.
And Gorilla opined that there was maybe there is a weasel sized casket down there.
Clever.
But I know Hogan took Boots to the Undertaker's casket.
Yeah.
At the beginning there, in a very unconvincing way. He didn't do a really good job. He basically knocked it off its pedestal. But greatest athlete in the world. You think he'd be able to destroy a simple coffin? But anyway, and Jason, actually, one of my Twitter followers actually asked a question. Would it be right if I share that with you? Or the question is, and I'll just paraphrase. This is from at Derek Bergen, and Derek asks, how do we think if I wish I could speak tonight. what do we think would have happened if this Tuesday in Texas had been successful? And in the event, if I mean, judging from the fact that they didn't replicate it or didn't go to multiple or more than four or five pay-per-views a year until 1995, right? It was 95?
Yeah, well, they added King of the Ring in
King of the Ring in 93.
But yes, you're right. 95 was the first In Your Hat. Yeah, it did 140,000 buys, which this Survivor Series itself did 300,000. The year before, Survivor Series did in 400,000. 140,000 buys would have been around the level that your average WCW pay-per-view would do, like in 92 and 93. It would have been very close to that. So I, you know, it's hard to kind of gauge. Obviously, they didn't do it again. So, for a while. So obviously, they didn't consider it a big success.
Well, and I recently learned, listening to your podcast, that 92-93 was the doldrums of WCW. So if that's what they were, if that's what they did, they couldn't have been happy
with
it.
That is interesting. I don't know. I mean, I guess it gets them into monthly pay-per-view sooner, or at least more frequent pay-per-view sooner. It would be interesting if they would do it more often like this, where they would like kind of set up a pay-per-view off of a pay-per-view. Because obviously they did have the weekend syndicated shows to kind of hype this Tuesday in Texas after the show. But, you know, 6 days is not very long, you know. And, I think there is a decent likelihood that the Thanksgiving weekend WWE syndicated programming would not be the highest rated of the year. That's a weekend where people travel and, you know, where you might skip that week pretty easily. So maybe, you know, you're setting up with on a pay-per-view and setting up that weekend is not like the best or the best time to, set up a show. That's tough. I mean, I guess it probably would have just been sort of Raw era storytelling a few years earlier. I mean, if they, you know, if they went to monthly, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
You see, I don't know. I mean, because I'm basically going chronologically through the network's archives. Mm-hmm. So I've been watching all the Clash of the Champions and NWA, WCW, and WWE pay-per-views in the order that they came out. And just the amount of content that they put out, like the big shows with the clashes, you know, almost like 3 weeks before, I'm up to 89 now.
Yeah.
And it just feels like so much. And that the story, it's kind of the storytelling that we have now. So I don't know. I don't know that it would have matured the storylines. You know, I think that was just something that kind of organically happened in the, in the build up to the Attitude Era. But I don't know. I think it would have just the longer stories that we kind of like about this era would have gone away. I don't know that the content would have matured.
Yeah, that I didn't mean. I meant the pace of the storytelling.
Yeah.
That was kind of where I was going with that. It was more, yeah, we would just have faster, I guess we would have. It would have been interesting because there are probably pay-per-view matches that we would have gotten, like some of the like Hogan feuds from like that were kind of important of the mid to late 80s are a little bit kind of somewhat forgotten or not as well remembered as maybe they should be because they didn't happen on pay-per-view. Like the Orndorff feud, they do have the big event, so which is actually on the network now, so the reputation of that may be enhanced a little bit because there's a quote big match to point to for that feud now. But
something like Macho Man, Bad News Brown, right? Mentioned tangentially around like the Survivor Series 88, but we never see the match, and like I would kind of like to have seen it in that, you know, if they were more frequent shows like Clashes or this Tuesday in Texas or something like that, you know, maybe we would have gotten more of that high level stuff, you know, and maybe that does something too, like make, because I think you mentioned like Jake Roberts didn't really have these great marquee matches, you know, during these runs.
Sure.
So we never got to see him work with someone great. And maybe, you know, maybe they would have, you know, opened up the opportunity to do, you know, more matches or, you know, showcase something with like a, you know, more matches with DiBiase or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, you, and I'm sure you would have had, I'm sure Flair Hogan would happen on pay-per-view, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you would have had, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think basically what would have happened kind of around 95, it just in terms of like how they structured the pay-per-views would have just happened a few years earlier. That's probably, I don't see necessarily any major changes other than that. And then that's a pretty big change. But
yeah, and it's very in your housey. I mean, the Tuesday in Texas.
Oh yeah,
it feels like it, like, you know, even
even less maybe first, than in your, you know, to be honest.
Oh my God, yeah, the you know, Slaughter and Duggan versus the Beverly Brothers. Give me Bret Hart versus Hakushi any day.
Sure.
So yeah, so it felt like one of those underdone in your houses.
Yeah, I would. I mean, that's fair. So. So, Dutch, why don't you plug what you would like to plug?
Well, my Twitter handle is at Dutch Lombrowski, and the last name is Lombrowski. I host a show about family travel called Mighty Men of Mouse. If you have any interest in family travel or Walt Disney World or things like that, you know, give it a listen. Maybe you'll be interested.
All right, and of course you can check WrestleSpective out on – we are at voicesofwrestling.com, and you can find new shows there. Also, we're working on restoring the archive of past shows, which will hopefully be available at Voices of Wrestling within a month or so. You can find I'm on Twitter at WrestleSpective. Also have a Facebook page, and can be found on iTunes and Stitcher. Would love if people who are enjoying this program could leave reviews and ratings on iTunes and Stitcher. That would be totally awesome. That would help spread the word about WrestleSpective. That's about it. Thanks again, Dutch, for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
And, oh, thank you so much, Jason. It was a dream come true.
Oh, thanks so much.
No, you have one of the best wrestling podcasts out there. It's a joy every time a new one comes out, and it just gets me excited to watch wrestling. Great wrestling.
Oh well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that, and thanks everyone for checking out the show. I appreciate everyone who listens and takes the time to chat with me or comment or discuss in any way. I always appreciate good feedback. So thanks again, and everyone, take care.